It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're catching up on our sleep news and research this hour with Dr. Eric Dykin, neurologist and director of the Sleep Disorders Program Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He joins us in our Iowa City studio. Dr. Dykin, welcome back to our studio.
Thanks for having me.
We like to have Dr. Dykin in, three, four times a year to answer your sleep questions and also explain to us some of the fascinating sleep research that we're finding in the news. Also, some of that research being done at the University of Iowa. We like to reach out to you during the hour and ask you, how's your sleep? You can share your sleep problem, an unusual sleep experience this hour, or perhaps of a loved one. Perhaps you've changed something in your life that's led to better sleep, and we can learn from that. 1-866-780-9100, toll free, 1-866-780-9100. Email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook. You can leave your question or comment on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, or also you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's go to some sleep news if we could. Before we do, go to callers and people on our social media wanting to have their queries answered. This sleep research published within the last few weeks in Nature Neuroscience, the journal here, has to do with brain circuits, Dr. Dykin, and reading about this. Understand brain circuits control sleep-wake cycles and consciousness, but a lot of it is still a puzzle. According to this new research, researchers have identified the specific brain circuit that wakes us from sleep and something that could have implications here. It sounds a bit complicated, but you're so good at explaining very complicated things in down-to-earth terms. I wonder if you can help us understand this discovery, this study, and why it's significant.
Yeah, and they oversimplify it to some extent, as you say, and that's the best way to start. And they've been using this biological technique called optogenetics, and they use light to control cells and living tissues, and in this case, typically neurons in the brain, in brain areas that help control sleep onset and offset. And that starts with the hypothalamus and its interaction with the thalamus. So there's this biologic clock you see that you can stimulate with this technique to see what it does to the animal to make it wake up or go to sleep. And in this series of tests, they took mice, and with the circadian rhythm parts of the brain, they would stimulate it and they could induce arousal. And if they would decrease the stimulation with light, it would be just like us going to sleep. And they found a little circuit that follows the day-night schedule that we typically follow.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the implications for us as humans at some point? Does this tell us that we didn't know before?
Yeah. They've sort of localized a little bit more that biologic clock that is responsible for having you wake up and having you go to sleep. Now that they've localized it, they can look at the neurotransmitters, the chemicals intrinsic to these cells. And what they hope to do is in people who have problems with sleepiness or insomnia, difficulty initiating or maintaining sleep, find what the chemical abnormality is within the circuit that they've localized, and then think of a good pharmaceutical, a drug-related treatment for people who may have had injury or abnormal circuits in their brain, the biologic clock.
Mm-hmm. Don't the medicines that we have for sleep trigger those chemical responses already, or we're sort of, to a certain extent, feeling around in the dark because we don't understand completely the mechanisms at work?
It's interesting. There's a variety of things that can cause people to keep wide awake. Amphetamines are one, and there are a variety of chemicals and drugs that can cause a person to go to sleep. Benzodiazepines are another drug class that have been more and more focused on because we're getting better and better at localizing this center. So this center has led to the development of amphetamines to keep people awake. But again, there are side effects potentially with this drug if you don't eat it, and benzodiazepines, for example, to keep people asleep. But still, with side effect, wouldn't it be nice to get more and more to the core of this center, this biologic clock, and find a medicine without the side effects that we can see with amphetamines and, for example, an overdose of a sedative?
Mm-hmm. So this new research published in Nature Neuroscience, a step possibly in that direction which you're describing.
Necessity and safety.
Okay. Dr. Eric Dykin with us, neurologist, director of the Sleep Disorders Program Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Join us with your question. Share your sleep problem or unusual sleep experience this hour, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Jason. Jason calling from Humboldt. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
Have you run into some sleep problems?
Well, yes, I have. You're talking about your biological clock or your sleep clock. I think mine's running backwards. I work for the railroad, and I've worked for years swing shift, so I've always had an interrupted sleep cycle. And I was finally able to get on a regular job where I was having nights off, but now they've switched everything, and I'm working overnights again. And for the past 2 months, I've been trying to train my body to work to overnights, so actually starting work about between 10 and midnight and not getting off between 10 and 11 in the morning. So my doctor has tried to give me like temazepam and Ambien and things like that to try and help me initiate that sleep cycle during the early, during the afternoon so I can go to bed and have a night's sleep, but I'm not having any luck. So I'm just wondering if Dr. Dykin has any suggestions on how I can, kind of get back to something normal, because I'm going on many weeks now without any really good sleep.
Wow, Jason, thank you for sharing that. That is no fun. At one time or another, most people have been through a period of deprived of sleep. It is a horrible thing to get through, Jason. Let's see what Dr. Dykin has to say.
And a lot of us shift work. I shift work. I work at night because I have a sleep laboratory. But we're fighting Mother Nature. And you just can't fight Mother Nature. And that's one of the reasons we're finding insomnia may be a greater problem today than it used to be in the past, because we can work 24 hours a day, even at night, when we're really physiologically supposed to be asleep. So there are a few things you can adjust with good sleep hygiene-like practices. And as you've implied, number one is try to keep that same schedule 7 nights a week. For every 1 hour of bedtime arousal time that a young person has, and I didn't even ask your age, but a young person with all the cells in their biologic clock, it takes them about a 24-hour period to adjust to that shift. So if you fly to Europe, for example, and I know I've said this before, 7-hour change, it's going to take you a full week, jet lag, if you will, to adjust. And this is the shift work problem we've had. So an awful lot of us, we work 5 days, then you have 2 days to get back with your family during the day. Boom, you're right at behind the eight ball.
So the idea you're telling Jason, stay on that 7 days a week, even if you only work 5 days overnight, stay on it?
Stay on it 7 nights a week, or else you're resetting the biologic clock, and Mother Nature doesn't like that. Number two, over age of 50, we call that I just have to bite my tongue. We call that elderly in sleep medicine. So you and I don't know what your age is, but I'll tell you, we've dropped out the cells. So we're not as fast as we used to be. We're not as strong as we used to be because of our muscular changes. And we also don't sleep the same as we used to. We've dropped out cells from that biologic clock. To adjust to changes, it's much harder for us as we get over the age of 50. Some of us are just not genetically or age-wise ready, prepared to play NFL football or with the Hawkeyes. We're getting older and we can watch, but some of us really are not genetically or age-related prepared or capable of handling that kind of a stress biologically. Mm-hmm. So age is another issue. Now, there are ways you can try to fool the system without drugs. Many of the medicines that he brought up are drugs that were made to mimic the sleeping chemicals in the hypothalamus. But even that is still trying to fool Mother Nature with some side effects we already referred to. But bright light therapy, you find on a nice diary, follow that for a couple of weeks, find out your sleepiest periods of time, then maybe get a bright light glasses or bright lights that you can get on the internet. And there's a level of illuminance called lux. And right around 10,000 lux, you get this light. So you either wear the glasses or sit in front of it for about a 30, 45-minute period. Find what works for you and see after about a 3 or 4 day period, you feel better. You won't be perfect, but if it works for you, wouldn't that be great? One way to try to fool Mother Nature, but side effect, it can make you hypomanic and maybe ahead too much of my bright light therapy over the weekend. I don't know. But
So Jason, maybe bright light therapy would be something you could talk with your doctor about and try out. And these are not just any lights. These are special lights with the wavelengths that do trigger those things in the brain.
So you don't hurt your retina, et cetera. Bright light can be a potential side effects, as we said.
Okay. Jason, we hope that helps you a little bit.
Thank you.
Okay. 1-866-780-9100. Dr. Eric Daikin, neurologist and director of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Let's fit in with some news, some research as we go through some of the research since the last time you were in our studio, Dr. Daikin. So some new research that has to do, and you were talking about getting older and how our sleep changes when we're getting older. So we all notice how when we get older, you learn that mornings are more golden, it seems, than they used to be. And those who are not in those age groups, you say, well, those seniors, they sure get up at the crack of dawn. Well, there's a reason for that. Psychiatry researchers, this is at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, now found that the circadian rhythm of our gene activity changes with age. You've looked at this study, Dr. Daikin. Translated, what does that mean? What have they found out?
And, you know, if you think about it, it makes sense to all of us. A newborn infant is what we call ultradian. It will sleep. That child will sleep 4 to 5 full sleep-wake schedules over a 24-hour period. When you reach around age 12, 13, 14, you start sleeping about 9 to 12 hours of sleep per night. When you reach adolescence, young adulthood, you often stay up a little later, and you sleep in a little later. We call that advanced sleep phase. When we get older, we drop out, simplistically, cells from that sleep-wake biological clock system that we've referred to so many times already today. And one of the effects is we tend to phase advance. So when we lose cells in that biological clock, the suprachiasmatic nucleus, now we finally named it, we tend to go to sleep earlier and we tend to wake up earlier. And for some of us, it works out really well. But for people who are still working, sometimes that can be a problem.
Mm-hmm. And so this University of Pittsburgh Medicine looked at the gene activity changes with age. So they're finding out sort of what we already knew but confirming it with these studies.
Yeah, and it's really sort of interesting, and it gets a little complicated, but there is this part of the biologic clock that during a certain stage of sleep generates a rhythmic activity that is parallel with what we call non-REM sleep. And what they found is that in the older brains, there was a loss of this rhythmic activity in a number of what they called core clock genes. And that may explain some of the problems that we have as we get older and older. But since they've localized that, they're hoping the same thing that the other researchers have hopefully looked at. If they can see the neurochemical abnormalities of this specific circuit that they're examining, maybe they could come up with pharmacological treatments to cure that or treat that. But guess what? My dad, who's almost 90 years old now, when we tried the bright light therapy, that was one therapy for this, he said, I don't need it. I like to wake up early. I get more done. It's quiet. And I like to go to bed early because I'm not out partying and jumping around and I don't have to work anymore.
If it suits you, then there's no problem. No problem to fix.
Yeah. First, do no harm.
All right. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to our callers again as we talk with sleep specialist Dr. Eric Daikin of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Maria in Iowa City, good afternoon to you.
Hi, good afternoon. Love the conversation. Quick question, if sleep deprivation will ever be considered a public health issue, it seems like a lot of people who have to work the overnights maybe don't work in the most affluent positions, and I almost think that it's a right as human beings to get good sleep. And if the doctor thinks that public health will ever get really involved with sleep hygiene for our country and our world.
Mm. Interesting question. It does what cost the economy money? It costs lives on the highway. Dr. Daikin, what do you have to say?
Well, in fact, I think it's a topic we may be talking about a little bit later. But Dr. Seisler, one of our great researchers in sleep medicine, has looked at this issue on sleep deprivation in physicians, in young physicians, and we know that the night shift, when we're trying to work at night, we make more mistakes, but it's the way of the world. What do you do when a person is bleeding to death after a horrible accident at 2 in the morning? You have to be there. But Mother Nature is still fighting with you. You really are not going to function as well. So the better sleep you can get, the more consolidated it can be, the more consistent you can be, the better prepared you can be in this triage, this battlefront kind of a situation. So it has been recognized, and in one of these papers, the CDC, Center for Disease Control, et cetera, has recognized, and they've still recommended, and it's controversial, that you should try to get 7 or more hours of sleep within a 24-hour period to be functioning the best that you can. But there's still a controversy. Is it just 7 to 9 hours of total sleep, or is it sleeping at the right time? So it has been recognized as a public health problem, an explosion. But how to deal with it? And that's why I've got a job, and that's why Ben invites me to talk about it. Yes, it has been recognized. So, and our shift workers, they're really on the front lines of research right now. That's what we've been talking about so far.
Okay, Dr. Eric Dykin, fitting in with a new study, challenging the notion that we that we'd get too little sleep. This is an interesting study that finds that Americans on average sleep as much as people in 3 different hunter-gatherer societies. There are a few societies left on our planet where there is no electricity. The lifestyles have remained largely the same for thousands of years. This is new research on sleep published in Current Biology, the journal. It shows that these hunter-gatherers, there are 2 tribes in Africa, 1 in South America. They're relatively fit and healthy despite, Dr. Dykin, despite regularly sleeping amounts that are near the low end of those in our industrialized society. So which is it? We are being told we are depriving ourselves of much-needed sleep, but then you look at people who've been groups that have been living this way for thousands of years, and it turns out they're pretty healthy. They're pretty fit. Yeah. What are your thoughts?
And this is Jerome Siegel again, and he was challenging that mandate that came from the CDD that said we should try to get 7 more hours of sleep, and that's why he did this experiment. Do you really need 7 or more hours of sleep, or is it the quality of sleep that you're getting? So he said, what did our forefathers and foremothers, how did they used to sleep? So he went to these Aboriginal tribes, if you will, and he found that on average, the tribes people slept just 6.5 hours, slightly less than the average American in the United States. But what he found that this is probably the quality of sleep and their circadian element, sleeping at the right time. They had no regular light source, and it wasn't just exposure to light, but because of that, they tended to go to sleep usually relatively soon after the sun went down. But what happens when the sun goes down? The temperatures go from a peak and they start to drop. And they usually woke up after the light had risen, the sun had risen in the morning, when the temperatures start to come up. And we've noticed for years that that siesta, when you're really tired at 1 to 3 in the afternoon, you really feel tired, there's a normal, natural body temperature peak that starts to drop and mm-hmm. you get sleepy. So he was saying the quality of sleep that these forebears, essentially mimicking what we probably used to do because of the way the light system was, you went to sleep when it was dark, you woke up when it was light, and it followed a body temperature curve. And he thinks one of the major problems with society today is we have something these native people, if you will, and I mean that with all due respect, didn't have. They had no control. They lived in huts, no temperature control. We have temperature control, so in my house, it's usually 70 degrees all the time, except I noticed this. I read this article and went, we put on the fan, we turn down the heat at night, and we've got comforters. We drop the temperature every night, and we sleep as is implied here. He believes that modernization has reduced this natural association of good sleep with a temperature drop and a temperature increase.
Dr. Eric Dykin with us, a sleep disorders expert from the University of Iowa. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Coming up on a break in 3 or so minutes, but we have time, I think, for Jim from Des Moines calling in. You have a sleep problem to share with us, Jim?
Yes, sir. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I got married about 8 months ago to my wife, Rachel. And so we've been both getting adjusted to sleeping next to each other. But basically what's happening is it's a tough one because it's both infrequent and sporadic enough that we've had a hard time figuring out what's causing it. But I've had myself a occasionally like an involuntary muscle spasm that's actually woken me up, but it only happens very, very rarely. But Rachel has something that's kind of similar, but it's probably on a smaller scale. And it's hard to say exactly how often it happens. I would say it's probably one out of every 3 or 4 days. But when it does happen, it usually happens, maybe like 5 or 10 minutes apart. And it's enough to keep me from going to sleep sometimes. And we actually started like an Excel sheet to try to get some data on what the factors were.
Doing a little sleep journal. That's very good. Okay. Jim, we're coming up on a break. I think we have the essentials, and we'll turn it over to Dr. Dykin to give his reaction to the newlyweds there in trouble with sleep.
Yeah. Well, and again, there's this commonality that you see a muscle spasm. There's a big body jerk. There's a movement. There's an arousal that's so great that it's affecting the other individual. Now, there's a lot of movement-related problems in sleep in our international classification. And one of the biggest ones is obstructive sleep apnea. When you become low in oxygen, when you have obstructive apnea, you've got a floppy throat and the muscles in the throat relax. And when they relax in the deeper stages of sleep, it's like a wet straw. You suck in and the airways can close off. The body's response to that is to jerk itself awake. And it can do that over and over and over and over. And it can disrupt the other bed partner too. That's only one of 67 differential diagnostic problems I could have for you. Take that list, go to your local doctor, and sit down, get a full history and physical exam, and then see what in that 67 differential is most likely for you and or your wife.
Okay, Jim, a few hints there. I guess mainly get to your doctor, and it sounds like you've gathered some good data. Continue to do that. That can only help the doctor.
Good history.
Okay, very good. Jim in Des Moines, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll be back in just a few minutes as we continue our conversation, regularly catching up with our sleep news and research. Dr. Eric Dykin, neurologist, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, said when we come back, we'll look at a new study, this one out of Australia, warning doctors and parents not to provide melatonin to children to help control their sleep problems. We'll hear Dr. Dykin's opinion on that when we return. Share your sleep problems, your unusual sleep experience this hour, 1-866-780-9100. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more from Dr. Eric Dykin in just a moment.
Everybody seems to think I'm lazy. Well, I don't mind. I think they're crazy. Running everywhere at such a speed. Too late, fine. There's no need. There's no need. Please don't spoil my.
And we're back midstream in River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, we're going to remember some notable Iowans in the news who passed away in 2015. Tomorrow on the program. Today, it's our regular sleep news and research show, catching up on the latest research, very interesting research in the past few months. Dr. Eric Dykin translating some of that into some language, some wordage that we can better understand. And we're also taking your calls. Share your sleep problem, your unusual sleep experience with us this hour, 1-866-780-9100. We do have a lot of people who want to talk to you, Dr. Dykin, but I wanted to mention this first, this email from also an Eric. Please ask the doctor what he recommends for sleep for kids on stimulants like Ritalin, if not melatonin. Now, before the break, I mentioned melatonin, a new study there. Sleep researchers at the University of Adelaide, this is in Australia, warning doctors and parents not to provide this drug, melatonin, to children to help control their sleep. In this recent paper published in the Journal of Pediatrics and Child Health, the head of the Circadian Physiology Laboratory at the University of Adelaide's Research Institute warns that providing melatonin supplements to children may result in serious side effects when the children are older. Maybe remind us, what is melatonin, and do you share this concern, Dr. Dykin?
Yeah. Melatonin is a synthetic form of a naturally occurring hormone that rises in response to the sun going down. So when the sun goes down through your eyes in this very complex circuitry. It's recognized by the brain, and melatonin says, it's dark, might as well go to sleep. And so it's a synthetic formulation of that. And in the past, there have been studies on blind children, blind adults, children and adults with brain injuries of this circadian center, the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is a go-between between the sun going down and the melatonin center or the pineal gland. So sometimes if you don't have the circuitry or that part of your brain is injured and you don't have the melatonin, you supplement with what may be lacking. But what they've shown recently, and it hasn't been proven in scientific published data, but this was their spiel. It was really pretty interesting. Many of the parents who had had children had problems with insomnia said, oh, this drug is a godsend. It's causing peacefulness and quiet throughout the house. Nevertheless, what they thought, some of the kids were on a strength that just knocked the parents out. So parent adult doses don't necessarily correlate to children doses. Mm. Mm-hmm. And the effect may be different on them. And what the researchers biggest concern was there are drugs out there that have side effects. We've already talked about amphetamines keep you awake, have a side effect. Benzodiazepines can get you to sleep, have a side effect. Melatonin might help get you to sleep, could have a side effect. One of the things we miss is something that Dr. Seisler is mentioning, common sense, in his research. Go to bed at the right times. Wake up at the right times, like our forebears used to do. Play off Mother Nature. It's tough to be a shift worker, and the kids probably not shift workers. So, but it's the first thing to look at. So sleep hygiene, cognitive behavioral therapeutic interventions is the formal term. When is your child, whether they're on Ritalin or not, because that effect should be wearing off toward the evening hours. So first of all, look at that overall history. How late is the child taking a stimulant? Maybe they're taking it too late in the day. They really need to be taking it at 8 o'clock at night? Probably not. So maybe something easy to adjust. What is the bedroom environment like? Is the child going to bed with the TV on, with their electronics? We've talked about that so many other times at these meetings here on the show. Again, that's going to be stimulating excitement. That's going to keep the kids up even longer. We know that from research. Is the bedroom quiet and cool? We've just talked about what Seisler saw, a little bit cooler. The temperature from the night going to day, it goes down from day to night. A little bit cooler room, 69, 70 degrees. Quiet environment, dark environment so that the bright light is not stimulating these centers. And are you giving the child the full amount of sleep? So look at that first.
And consult your doctor, as always, recommended by Dr. Eric Dyke. And thank you for that email from our listener, Eric. Let's go to phones. We want to quickly go through some of the concerns here to get some advice from Dr. Dyken or response. Matthew is in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Matthew. What's on your mind concerning sleep?
Well, I just had kind of a question, I guess. And so I got married a couple of years ago, and it was the first time that I've ever really like slept with anyone for like a long period of time, more than like dating for a little bit. And I just don't sleep as well at night. And one of the things I always bring up to my wife is, and she don't like it when I bring this up, is that my grandparents had separate beds. And one thing that my grandfather always seemed to me was very well rested. And my parents never slept in separate beds, but I know a lot of my grandparents' friends that did, and I didn't know what your guys' thoughts were on that. I'm not saying I'd like to go back to it for sure, but I like the idea of it. I don't think I would wake up in the middle of the night as much as I do now,
okay,
which I didn't before we got married.
Very, very good question. We only have to go back to our sitcoms, early sitcom history, to find out that Dick Van Dyke and Mary Tyler Moore, they were in separate beds. So this is a common thing. And I'm looking here at a statistic. Before you chime in here, Dr. Dyken, according to the National Sleep Foundation, 1 in 4 couples sleep in separate beds today.
Well, yeah, Lucy and Desi, Fred Flintstone, I mean, and Barney and his wife. And it is interesting, and there are cultural, psychological elements. My wife's family is from China. The family bed is something that children would stay in the bed until their teens, more of a culturally, psychologically satisfying way to sleep. So there's a psychological component. Then there's also a physiological component. So I know of friends when we were growing up, mom sleeps there, dad sleeps there. And I know why they slept in different rooms, because mom or dad snored like a banshee. So you had said grandfather slept well, but how did grandma sleep? Did grandma snore, gas so much with big, quote-unquote, we've already heard this today, body jerks to the point where, how am I going to get to sleep with this? My children are adults now, and they're growing away from me. They will not go on vacation unless I wear my CPAP mask. And I said, oh, well, you're worried about my health? They said, Dad, I have to bunk with you. I can't stand the snoring. One element of the 60-some differential diagnostic categorization of sleep disorders that can cause for a very disruptful night of sleep, not only for the patient, but for anyone sleeping in the bed. So one of the thoughts is, psychologically, you may feel better sleeping independently, but always look, and that's my concern when I look at friends and families who say, we have to sleep in separate rooms. Why? I snore like a banshee, or I jerk all night. I always want to rule out the most dangerous sleep disorder I know of, at least one of the most, obstructive sleep apnea, because it can be a silent killer.
Okay. Hope that helps. So a lot of factors there, Matthew. But I think one of the things is if your sleep is – if you get your sleep checked out and your sleep – you and your wife have normal sleep, there's nothing wrong with sleeping in different beds.
Well, I don't think so.
Right. No, thank you.
Okay. Matthew in Cedar Rapids, thank you very much. Let's talk a little bit about something that's going on at the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics where you are working, some of your students working on ways to help those with muscular disorders sleep. Briefly tell us about that before we go back to some callers.
Yeah, my colleague Dr. Im and my students Dr. Hong and Dr. Clemens are working on a few research studies that they hope to present this year in June at the American Academy of Sleep Medicine regarding patients with muscular dystrophies. Now, we know that Lou Gehrig's disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, Duchenne muscular dystrophy that affects young adults and young children. These are disorders where you progressively stop breathing and often at night, early on, hypoventilate. We have ventilatory support mechanisms that can prolong and improve quality of life for these individuals. But we've also found once you treat some of the disorders, the patients, and one of this is dystonia myotonica, the myotonic dystrophy, they're still sleepy. And you, well, I thought I took care of your problem. You breathe all night now. You don't wake yourself up gasping. Uh-huh. Shouldn't you feel wide awake? Well, there may be other areas of the body and brain, maybe even that biologic clock that may be degenerating, and these patients may often need to be candidates for some of the new pharmaceutical therapeutic interventions and maybe even holistic interventions, sleep hygiene recommendations that we've already discussed throughout the talk so far. Not just say it took care of your breathing and leave you on your own and lonesome. So we found that some people with specific muscular dystrophies, even after treated, continue to have undue sleepiness. And that's what they want to present this year. Treat not only the breathing, that's important, but good sleep is important for restoration.
Okay, let's see if we can go back in quick fashion, go through some of the callers so our hour doesn't end with too many people disappointed not being able to talk to Dr. Eric Dykin of the University of Iowa Sleep Disorders Center. Harvey is in Fort Dodge. Harvey, you have a sleep question related to driving I see on my screen.
Yes. Hi, Ben. Hi, Doc.
Hi.
I hope you can enlighten me a little with this issue. In my 20s and through my 40s, we would take a summer vacation in Montana, and I could find typically that I could drive 12 to 14 hours, and it was not a problem. And now I'm in my early 60s, and I find I can be sleepy in an hour and a half.
Mm.
It's an issue in terms of my wife and I driving, and I thought perhaps, you know how our glasses have gone from the aviator style to this smaller stuff, and having bifocals, I thought maybe it was eye fatigue. So I switched to some driving glasses, but that didn't do a thing. So any thoughts you have on this, I'd appreciate it.
I know you're not alone, Harvey, in Fort Dodge, that driving puts you asleep, or being a passenger in a car could put you asleep too. A common problem. Do you have any thoughts on that, Dr. Daikin?
Highway hypnosis. But, you know, as is implied, good, smart people look at the different things, and the things that aren't working, that's when you go to see your physician, because most of the things that we have, we can often figure out on our own. But it wasn't the glasses in this case. But when you talk about eye fatigue, that's different than falling asleep behind the wheel of a 40-ton rig, which we know is a bad, dangerous thing to do. So actually being sleepy is different from eye fatigue and sleepiness, as I've implied before. There's an international classification of sleep disorders, and it's recently been updated. There are 67 specific differential diagnostic categories of disorders which could result in enough sleepiness while you're driving for even short periods of time to fall asleep behind the wheel of your car. So it happens. One of the most frequent ones that the Trucking Association has looked at is the association with untreated sleep apnea and the sleepiness that comes from waking yourself up over and over and over throughout the night. And by the way, we have some of the safest truckers in the world because of the research that has been done on truck drivers and people who drive long distances. So my thought is, you really should sit down with your physician, full history, full physical examination, and look for that differential diagnostic of treatable elements that could be leading to your daytime sleepiness. It could be that you're just trying to keep up with what you used to do, sleep 3 hours a night and go out there and drive 14. Well, you probably need more than 3 hours. But I think this problem is probably a little bit more difficult because you sound smart. You would be getting the 7 hours. There's something else out there that's affecting you. I would sit down with your physician or healthcare provider.
Okay. Harvey, thank you. In Fort Dodge, investigate that with your physician. Let's go to Steve. Also, according to my screen, you're also in Fort Dodge, Steve?
Yep, that's right.
All right. Go for it. We're winding up our hour. What's your sleep concern?
Sure. Well, I was recently diagnosed with narcolepsy, and I work a night shift. I also take an antidepressant along with a stimulant, and I still find that I struggle with just a lot of sleepiness, especially in my daytime hours, right after I wake up in the afternoon. I was just wondering, I've tried about everything I can as far as the sleep hygiene. I just wasn't sure if there's any other things that might help, and also if the prescriptions, if they might be hampering one another.
Okay. A narcolepsy, in other words, excessive sleepiness, Dr. Daikin?
Yeah. How old are you right now?
I am 31.
Yeah, 31's pretty old to be coming diagnosed with narcolepsy. And there are a lot of things that can look like the sleepiness of narcolepsy, which is an intrinsic deficit of orexin hypocretin in that biological clock. And usually the onset is young adolescence, and usually there's cataplexy, and someone tells you a funny joke, you fall to the ground. I would make sure you have the correct diagnosis. And for that correct diagnosis, you must be off all medications with a good sleep hygiene daytime diary for a minimum of 3 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks. Then what you need is the full overnight sleep study for as long as you can sleep, at least 7 hours. Then 1 to 2 hours after waking, you need the full 5 multiple sleep latency tests throughout the day to show you have early onset of REM, a very specific pathologic form of REM sleep, and you need to have drug levels checked at that time. Must be done to that nth degree. Nevertheless,
I have actually had all those done.
If you truly have narcolepsy, then what I would do is the spinal tap and look for the orexin hypocretin levels. They must be low. If they're not low, this is a different disorder. And it can look just like narcolepsy because there's some unusual elements. Nevertheless, in my opinion, it is going to be very difficult for a narcoleptic to do shift work. You already have a paucity of this wake-up chemical. Number two, if you're also on other medications, you're going to be very, very prone to the side effects of those medications. I would sit down with your doctor and then maybe even consider, Should the spinal tap be done to make sure this is the diagnosis of narcolepsy?
Okay, Steve, we'll have to leave it there in Fort Dodge. We wish you better sleep in the future.
Thank you very much.
Good luck.
Okay, let's go to our Wisconsin caller. Is it Mark in Wisconsin?
Yes, sir.
Okay, we're not hearing you too well, but give it a try. We'll see if we can understand your question. We're coming up to the end of the hour, so please make it brief.
Okay, my quick question is, I have a CPAP machine. I've been on it for a few years now. Since I've been diagnosed needing CPAP, I've lost about 80 pounds. But my question is when I use my CPAP, I don't dream at all. And when I don't use it, I do dream. When I do use it, I don't dream. I correlate dreaming with a good night's sleep. Am I correct?
Okay. Well, I think we got it, Mark. So CPAP eliminates his dreams, says Mark.
In your case, I would say no. I don't think that's correct. The reason – when I was first diagnosed with sleep apnea, I had the most horrific dream in my life, and it's called the isomorphic postulate by Hobson McCarley's from Harvard. I tend to dream I was drowning, and I woke up gasping, and my wife said, you know, you got apnea, and I got treated. So what happens is REM sleep, paralyzed sleep, is when your throat is the most floppy, and you can go into this dream, and when you start suffocating, you start having the horrific dreams, more dreams, and you wake up, and it's not always a horrific dream. But the bad dreams are often a major element that we associate with sleep apnea. Most of us forget that great dream. I mean, satisfaction, blue suede shoes, some great things have been forgotten in sleep, but we probably dream every night. When the dreams become more frequent or horrific, then I worry about being undertreated or not treated with sleep apnea. But if you have a good dream, God bless you. I look forward to those. And there are some people who can actually induce that into themselves.
Okay. Thanks, Mark in Wisconsin. Let's move quickly, very quickly, to Steve in Dubuque. If you can make it quick, we can get you an answer. Steve, hi.
Hi. My question is, you know, once a month or so, I'll take, you know, just a 2 or 3 hour nap during the day. But then I find in the middle of the night, I'm waking up very frequently. It's hard for me to get back to sleep. Just wondering, you know, should I just, you know, kind of ignore the fact that I'm tired and you know, not take a nap during the day,
okay,
you know, so that I sleep better at night.
Okay. Are those occasional naps throwing off his Steve's rhythms in Dubuque?
Well, you know, then there's this consistency. You have a sleep deprivation that leads to a buildup of chemicals that can make you sleepy. But then there's also that circadian rhythm, the biologic clock that's relatively immovable, if you will. So that sometimes if you don't sleep up, save up your sleep drive for the night, you get a real long nap, it sort of interferes with the depth of sleep you'll get at night. And we call sleep restriction therapy is avoiding the naps throughout the day. Nevertheless, if your routine is to have the power nap that Moss and Dr. Dement from Stanford have talked about, and I hope to do this when I retire, get a good half-hour nap between 1 to 3 every afternoon, and then set my nighttime schedule by that and go to sleep whenever it works and wake up whenever it works.
So does that mean you can subtract a half an hour from your night sleep if you get that half an hour during the afternoon?
I don't know if it's as simple as that, but it will affect your nighttime sleep to some extent. And what I want to do is not be surprised with I got the and I call it the delicious nap. I mean, it's a big deal. But I get the delicious nap and I screw myself up for the night. No, I think it's long habit and pattern, and you'll adjust to that accordingly. So don't be put off so much, but if you're a truck driver and you're really sleepy during the day, pull over, take that half-hour power nap, and then next time I'll tell you how to take a power nap. But incorporate the nap as to more your routine, and I think you'll adjust accordingly.
Okay, thank you very much. We've come to the end of the hour. Fascinating, always, talking with Dr. Eric Daikin as we catch up on sleep news from here at the University of Iowa, but also across the country, across the world for that matter. Dr. Daikin is a neurologist and director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Thank you for taking time to come by, Dr. Daikin. We appreciate it so much.
Thanks for having us.
All right. And tomorrow on this program, we'll remember some notable Iowans in the news who died in 2015. But we finished up our hour catching up on sleep news and research. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We wish you all the best of sleep. in tonight and the coming nights.
I need some sleep. Time to put the old horse down.